Hi, Simon Hill here. Enjoy our podcast? If you'd like to help us keep delivering the sort of quality football chat you want, then you can show your support by making a donation. Big or small, however much you can afford, we appreciate all your help, and every cent will be ploughed back into improving production. Thanks in advance from all of us at Shim, Spider, and so much more.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're with Shim, Spider, and so much more. Take it away, fellas.
Yes, hello again. Good to have your company for episode 48 of Shim, Spider, and so much more, our penultimate show of the season. And we have our final guest of the current run in Ufuk Talay to come a little later. We'll also look back on the weekend's A-League semi-finals and ahead to the big one next week as Sydney FC look to win an unprecedented third consecutive grand final against Premier's Melbourne City. All in the company of our two boys from the Golden Generation, Jelko Kalats and Craig Moore. How are you, boys?
Hello, boys. Yeah, I'm well.
How are you, Maury? Enjoying the Euros?
Yeah, no, it's been interesting, Simon, hasn't it? There's actually quite a few teams, you know, four or five teams, I think, that have looked decent with a really good opportunity, I think, to go on and win the tournament. Spider, the Italians have been unbelievable. Belgium have been impressive. So it's an interesting tournament, interesting tournament, but good games.
But Croatia haven't been impressive, Spider, where you're living at the moment. What's been the reaction over there?
Mate, we sort of, everyone expected it, to be honest with you. I don't know why. The euphoria around Croatia is not great for this Euros. We spoke about it. The last 6 months, they've not been great. They really haven't been great, and they've taken it into the Euros. They lack a striker. They don't have a goal scorer. And we know in big matches, you need a goal scorer. They just don't have it.
Okay, thanks, boys. We'll discuss the Euros in more detail a little bit later on in the show in London Calling, but let's get straight into it with Hard Talk.
Hard Talk.
Hard Talk is brought to you by Streamgate, one of Australia's first live streaming companies operating since 2008. They focus on virtual and hybrid events, broadcasting to unlimited online audiences worldwide by either a secure private stream page or publicly on social media. Live streaming allows social online engagement as viewers are able to communicate back to the presenters in real time while social distancing. So should you require a small personal event or business level webcast, then please go to streamgates.com.au or you can find them on Instagram. Well, boys, let's start our wrap with the A-League semi-finals. Sydney FC on Saturday through to a third consecutive end-of-season finale and a chance to create a bit of history. What did you make of their win over Adelaide United?
Look, I think it was... It was comfortable, Simon, although the goal from Juande, towards the back end of the game makes it a little bit more nervous in terms of the way that the game then finishes off. But, you know, I think that the first half in particular, Adelaide had some chances, but Sydney are just clinical, you know, with Bobo and Lafondre, you know, players, although Lafondre misses a penalty as well, which probably puts the game to bed. But even Sydney FC without, you know, some of their main players still look as if they've got that squad. Spider, I don't think any surprises your end either. We felt that Sydney would get to the grand final, and kind of that's what's happened, isn't it?
Yeah, they're showing their experience, Maury. You know, we spoke about it halfway through the competition. You know, we kept on talking about, don't worry, Sydney will be fine. Mate, they've got big-name players, they've got experienced players, and Maury, we all know what it's like. Sometimes, you know, when you win, it becomes a habit. And now the semis are on, the finals are on, the big players rise, and they're just a very, very good side. Adelaide, great season. Fantastic season. They'll be disappointed to go out, obviously, like anyone. But Carl Viet and his coaching staff, Ross Aloisi, Eugen Galekovic, and all the players, they've done a great job for Adelaide United, and they'll build on that.
VAR with two big decisions involved heavily in the outcome. Right decisions for you?
Yeah, I think they were. Right. Yeah, I think they were right as well. I think the first one, was it Barbarousis or Lafondo that gets
Barbarousis.
He definitely gets a touch at them, bounces under the keeper and back out the other side. He gets brought down. It's a penalty. Right decision. The second one, Barbarousis again, obviously. I didn't get all the replays of the offside night sort of stuff, but obviously for the penalty to be given, he was deemed to be onside. And I can see why it was a penalty. So I think there were two right decisions.
Much was made of Sydney's Socceroo absentees, Redmayne, Grant, McGowan, and understandably so. But how much did the Reds miss Craig Goodwin, who, of course, missed out through injury?
Yeah, massive player, important player for Adelaide United. That's for sure. And they missed him. Every team at the moment is struggling with players away. Now, Goodwin, as we all know, is a very, very good player in the A-League. Could he have made a difference in that match? Probably would have made a difference, but I still think Sydney would have gone on and won the match because they have more experience. And you know what the key to Sydney is now compared to halfway through the season? They got Lafondra and Bobo. Mm. They were missing chances for fun during the season. And everyone was, geez, Sydney's gone. They're not gone. They were still creating. Now they've got two goal scorers that can actually finish and do what Sydney do best and clinically finish off matches.
Right. See on that, and Simon, be interested to know your thoughts as well. So do you think that for Sydney FC, Lafondre and Bobo was part of a plan, or it was a little bit of luck with that in terms of recruiting players that they know have a history at the football club? Do you think it was part of a plan?
I think they got lucky. Simon?
I don't know whether you could say that they planned to bring them both back, because how could they know at the start of the season? Although there was talk about Lafondra maybe coming back after his stint in the Indian Super League. Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because obviously, if we remember, Lafondra was actually brought in to replace Bobo. And I remember when they signed them both, thinking, oh, that's going to be interesting. How they're going to play both. And where does Costa Barbarousis fit into all that? But I guess you can never have too many good attacking players. And Costa Barbarousis has been moved out wide. And the two of them seem to work very well in tandem. In fact, you know, Bobo is your classic sort of number nine, isn't he, really? Whereas Lafondra can play off the nine, and create and make those runs in behind as well. So, yeah, it's worked out very well for them. And obviously, they're two players that they know very well, and they trust them, and they deliver, and they did again at the weekend.
It was great recruiting. They changed where you could bring players in. Like, what was it, 2 or 3 weeks out of the semifinals because you know players were going away. And it was just great recruiting by Sydney FC. And the reality is, Maury, they must have had a great rapport with the club, because I guarantee you, Lafondra and Bobo have not come back for the money that they deserve to be on. They've come back as a gratis, really.
Yeah. No, you're spot on, and it's a really, really good point to make, Spider, because these players end up back at Sydney FC, whether it was planned, whether it was a little bit of luck, but the way that you treat your players when they're at your football club, if you do that in the correct manner, which Sydney FC obviously have done, and then you do have that opportunity to get these type of players coming back. And as we've just touched on there, the impact that they've made yet again, another grand final. So there's every possibility they'll go on and score goals and potentially win that as well.
They've struck a formula, haven't they, Sydney FC? And they've stuck to it. And three consecutive grand finals. I think it's now five in the last six seasons.
Seven.
Which is it right? Yeah. And you know, in a salary cap competition, that's extraordinary, really. So congratulations to Sydney FC. Just one more on that. A report that Sydney fans reportedly let off fireworks at 3 o'clock on Saturday morning outside Adelaide's hotel. Their response to that has been a bit mixed. People saying, oh, you know, that's cringeworthy and, you know, we shouldn't be doing that. And, you know, we're Australia and all this sort of thing. But I don't know, I sort of rate that.
I like it, Spider. You know what it was like when we were in there, Montevideo, mate, where it didn't stop all night. They're out singing and partying, and hey, it's part of the sport. You know, it's like your fans are still trying to get an advantage for the team the following day, mate.
Yeah, that's football, mate.
As long as nobody gets hurt, and no rules are broken.
Yeah,
that, mate. I tell you, it reminded me. I had a giggle to myself because we played Napoli 1 year with Milan. Mate, they made that much noise at the front of the hotel. They were banging drums, mate. They were singing. And the cops did not care less. You know what the result finished? Yeah, we got pumped. 3-0.
Good story. Let's move on and talk about the other semi-final. Melbourne City winning through to their second consecutive grand final, defeating MacArthur by 2-0. First of all, of course, this game was switched to Sydney because of the issues with the coronavirus. What are your thoughts on that? Was that the right decision by the APL? I know that, you know, they're between a rock and a hard place sometimes with this pandemic, but Melbourne City, I think you could sense as a club, felt quite aggrieved by that. And their supporters, of course, were absolutely incensed that it was essentially a home game for MacArthur.
Yeah, and rightly so. For me, look, I don't understand a lot of the decisions made, to be honest with you. Like, I know Victoria's having a bit of problems with COVID, but the regional parts of Victoria were open. There was possibilities for Melbourne City to play in Victoria. Now, I don't know the geography of Victoria that well, but I'm sure there was a stadium available to hold 4,000 or 5,000 people because that's all they would have got to the game. Mm. And Melbourne City, as the premiers, had to travel interstate. It was an away game and it was a home game for MacArthur. So, definitely heartfelt. Look, they deserve to be in the grand final, Melbourne City. 100% deserve to be in the grand final. So they can't now complain that they've got to worry whether they get a home grand final or whether it's going to be in Sydney again.
Well, that's the next question, isn't it? Where is the grand final played? Go on, Maury.
I'm saying, did Greg O'Rourke say, or did I see something that I think, you know, potentially they were talking about the game being at Amy? But again, I'm not up to date with all the.
I think they want to take the game to Amy Park because obviously Melbourne City have earned that right to host the grand final. Greg O'Rourke did say that they would try everything to get the game down to Melbourne. Look, in the end, it may not be possible. I don't know. But yeah, you would certainly sympathise for Melbourne City and their supporters having earned the right to host a grand final after all these years. And then it would be, it could be taken away from them for no reason, no fault of their own. Go on, Spider.
Yeah, yeah.
And the game itself was such a cliche where moments change matches. Maury, it was insane. MacArthur had three unbelievable chances, like 30, 32 and 33 minute to go one goal up. And I'm telling you, with that experience that MacArthur had, had they led in that match, Melbourne City were in big, big trouble.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, they had the chance where Mbambwa went round the goalkeeper.
Mm. Yep.
Got it cleared off the line. Franich had that unbelievable strike from 25, 30 yards off the crossbar.
And then there was another corner that was flicked across that he didn't, I don't know who it was, someone slid in and he didn't have a clear connection. Like, they had three unbelievable chances.
But Spides as well. And then you're talking about your chances, moments, goals, change games. And then when City get theirs, mate, bang, bang. and then off the kickoff again, bang. I mean, if that doesn't knock the stuffing out of you, then mate, I don't know what does. But in the end, City, they had to travel. You would have thought that potentially more would have been done for for the minor premiers, but they still went and got their result, and hopefully they can get their grand final at home. Amy Park would be nice for them.
I actually thought that this performance by Melbourne City was one of their best because they were without five key players. They had three Socceroos, Jamie McLaren, Curtis Good and Connor Metcalf, who we knew were going to be missing. Andrew Nabuts and Craig Noon were also out as well. And this was a day when the kids stood up. Stefan Kolakowski and Marco Tilio with the goals. But it seemed to signify for me, and we've talked about this a lot in the past about Melbourne City, a shift in their mentality. And Scott Jamieson alluded to this, Spider, after. I want to ask you this because you work there. Scott Jamieson actually praised, and he's done this all season, Warren Joyce for the change in mentality. And he said, look, I know people didn't particularly like the football that Warren Joyce played, but he instilled in us something a little bit different that perhaps we've been missing all these years. And that's that, you know, winning mentality to ride things out when the going gets a bit tougher. Is that fair? You worked there during those times?
Yeah, Joyce instilled hard work. He demanded it. He demanded hard work, and Melbourne City had always had a name for being like a bit of a soft club. And Joycey demanded every day to come in and work hard, give 100%. And it continued. And a lot of these young players were in the youth setup at that time. And it's continued with, look, Paddy Cosnorbo's been there for a long time. Monbet was there. He'd done a fantastic job at Melbourne City, and they've just carried it on. But I tell you who's made the biggest difference. Mate, Jamo can talk all he wants, but the senior players are the ones that have had to buy in to what Melbourne City is doing. And they're the ones now that their skin folds are good, that they're not overweight, that they can run, they can repeat sprint. That's called hard work. That's called being a professional footballer. And when you do that day in and day out, you get success. Melbourne City now are getting the hard work that, Joycey probably instilled and has now carried on in the next 2-3 years.
And congratulations to everyone at Melbourne City, and particularly Paddy Cosnorbo, of course, is through to his first grand final in his inaugural year as coach. Congratulations to Mark Milligan, fantastic career. That was obviously the end of his playing days. He will remain on the staff at MacArthur. For me, one of the most underrated Socceroos of the golden generation. He almost seemed to get forgotten a little bit because he wasn't, you know, a Tim Cahill. He wasn't a Lucas Neal. He wasn't a Harry Kewell or a Mark Viduka, or even, dare I say it, a Craig Moore or a Zeljko Kalats. But he was a terrific footballer and a sensational career. So well done to Millsy. Talking of the Socceroos, they've wrapped up qualification since we last spoke, boys, for the final round of Asian qualifying. 1-0 win over Jordan in their final game. Overall, how confident are you that this team will qualify for Qatar in 2022? Because, of course, in the final round, about to come up against the regional heavyweights, maybe Japan, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq. Arnie says he wants Iran, by the way, to fix 1997. But what are your thoughts on where we're at?
Be careful what you wish for, Simon. you're right. We go into this next stage and the bigger countries, and, you know, ones where we know is going to be a real test. And, that's always difficult because the region is improving continually. I've been really happy and impressed with this last batch of games. I think, like it says, with the work that Arnie's done in terms of, it's kind of a new look squad now. It looks as if it's been regenerated. Some other players coming in now, younger players, with the balance of the experience. It's something that we needed. But at the same time, when you get to that next stage, look, I think we do have a good chance. But you've got to be your best. We'll get to a level where you can't afford to make the mistakes because they will be punished. And the margins at this next stage will be a lot tighter than what we've seen in the recent matches.
No doubt. Spider, the Matildas still waiting for a first win under Tony Gustafsson, but they did at least get a draw against Sweden in their latest hit out. That's a team that they will face in the group in Tokyo at the Olympics after conceding 3 goals in 3 matches. That result has got to be a step in the right direction, I guess, for the national team.
Yeah, look, and his whole preparation would be towards the Olympics. There's no doubt about it. So he'll be... his main goal will be the Olympics. So, you know, we don't know what they're doing there. Are they training hard? Is he making them train under, you know, I don't know, under pressure, going into matches, tired, playing fatigued? That would be all in his preparation for the Olympics more, you know?
Well, yeah, but what do you think, I mean, in terms of normally, in terms of preparation games, in terms of potentially, you know, Sweden... are in their group, like Spider. That's a, and Simon, that's a little bit unusual in terms of you have a preparation game against a team that you're actually going to be competing against. And I believe that probably there was maybe an agreement in place between the Matildas and the Swedish national team in terms of maybe not playing their strongest 11s. And then you're thinking, well, what's the point of it? You know, that's a game. That's a preparation match.
The only reason I can think, Maury, is that in the time of a global pandemic, you know, maybe there aren't the options available to play, you know, too many different national teams. They played the Germans, they played the Netherlands. Obviously, you can't at the moment. They're operating with a European-based squad, so they're probably not able to go to Asia or, you know, play teams from South America because of the situation over there as well. So maybe this was, you know, virtually their only option. And it was a case of, you know, let's just have a game. And both nations maybe agreed. I don't know what the reason was.
But, yeah, it was a strange one for me as well.
Yeah, strange.
To think they were playing someone. But as you said, like, it is a global pandemic, mate. All things go at the moment.
Yeah. Just on the Socceroos and Matildas, before we move back to Clubland, of course, again, since we last spoke, the TV deal has been announced for the national teams and various other AFC rights. That's going to be on Channel 10 and Paramount Plus as well, along with the A-League and W League. That's got to be good for the game in this country, hasn't it? Having it all in one spot.
Brilliant.
Amazing.
Simple as that, right?
I think it is. Look, we've been pushing that for months. So that it's actually happened, Simon, I think is unbelievable for the game in Australia. I think it's fantastic also to you know, for the fan base and all that sort of stuff, to make it a seamless interaction to be able to go onto that one platform. I just think it's really a great opportunity now to really grow the game. So really pleased with it.
Yeah, I think everybody would agree that it's the last thing you want is having all the different strands of football on 4, 5, 6 different services and having to pay fees for all of them. So I think this is a win for the game as well. Before we move to the Euros in London Calling, just some news in Clubland over in Europe. Matthew Ryan, I don't know if you know anything about this one, Maury, reports in the papers in the UK that he might be on his way to join the Ange Postecoglou revolution at Celtic.
Yeah, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. Because look, I mean, the Greek goalkeeper that Celtic have got, which they spent a bit of money on, $5.5 million. I think he probably wasn't or hadn't had the best opportunity and all that sort of stuff. And I just feel that he'll probably get that opportunity under Ange to say that Matty Ryan at this moment today is a likely candidate for Celtic. I would say no today. Who knows, 4, 6 weeks. But at that stage, Matty Ryan would also like to secure his future.
Yeah. Sorry, go on, Spider.
Matty's got panels on that point, mate. I'd be chasing Matty all day long. But me and Maury have spoken off.
I spent a lot of money, mate.
We spoke off air about it. And I said, mate, Ange would be just clever to go get Matty Ryan as his first signing, because the way Ange wants to play, Matty suits perfectly. But financially, I don't know if Celtic can afford that.
Maury, has the hoo-ha about Ange's appointment died down yet in Scotland, or is it still raging?
No, it has. It's died down. I'm speaking to a lot of people, obviously, around about the Euros, and they're all intrigued. They're all asking me questions. You know, what about this? You know, Ange Postecoglou, what's he like? And they're starting to slowly turn in terms of like, okay, this is somebody that's maybe outside of the box for us, but he's a good coach. So the reports are coming through are good. He's got a good pedigree. He's a winner. He's a motivator. You come to Glasgow, you've got to win football matches, and it starts early with the Champions League qualifier. That's how he'll be judged. But I think Ange will do well.
And that qualifier is against Michelin, of course, where he'll come up against a certain Awamabil, which is interesting. Yeah. One final one, Spider, this one for you. Alan Stajic has left the Central Coast Mariners this week, saying he wants a new challenge. Sounds to me like there's been an issue. When he finished third at a club that wasn't expected to do so, and then leave at the end of the season.
Yeah, well, he's basically seen where Central Coast Mariners stand. He actually would have went in, and we all know he'd done a fantastic job, but you can't rest on your laurels. He knows he has to reinvest and recruit players to be another. He wants to go further. He wants to go to second. He wants to go to first next year. And if he doesn't recruit, he can't go there. And he would have probably gone in, and they would have said to him, there's no more money. And he's on a hiding to nothing if he stays. Because if he stays, and other clubs around the country that weren't as successful this year, and they recruit properly, Central Coast Mariners are going to finish outside the top six next year. And who's going to be blamed? Alan Stajic. So this he might as well leave and wait for a better opportunity.
I agree.
Go on, Maury.
I agree.
I just think it's a very, very smart move. You know, I kind of think, I even think about a little bit, Spides, when I was at Brisbane and John Aloisi on the back of the season where we were 1 point off a winning the league. I think we drew down at Melbourne Victory to win the minor championship. And looking back, that was the time that Johnny should have left Brisbane. Like sometimes you're better off going when your stock's high. Rather than, like you says, I mean, Central Coast Mariners, there's still a lot of issues behind the scenes. Club's still up for sale. You're still going to be running at a shoestring budget. Alan Stajic, he went in there and done an unbelievable job this season. This is a very smart move, I believe.
Okay. We'll see who gets the job at the Central Coast Mariners. Thanks for the moment, boys. We're going to head overseas and talk about the Euros. London calling.
London calling.
Go further with the Australian College of Physical Education. With more than 100 years of experience, ACPE's courses are designed to get you career ready. Their bachelor degrees in sports performance and business, health science, applied fitness, education and dance can help turn your dream into a career. Find out where ACPE can take you. Apply online today for Semester 1 2021. At acpe.edu.au.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, let's talk about the European Championships. That's the big tournament that is attracting an awful lot of attention around the globe at the moment. Happened a couple of days ago, boys, but England 0, Scotland 0. The headlines screaming England in crisis. I'm not sure that's fair after 4 points from the first six. However, it was disappointing by England, but the Scots, Maury, very resolute. And in particular, a performance by a young player called Billy Gilmore caught the eye.
Yeah. I actually think, Simon, take the possession in terms of the possession stats. Scotland were a better side. Scotland had the better opportunities in this match. Billy Gilmore, who doesn't play week to week at Chelsea, But look who he's behind. When you see Conte, main man for France, you look at Jorginho, starring for Italy. This young boy, 20-year-old, for his first international start, his international debut, starting debut, was incredible. He's an unbelievable talent. But I also felt that Kieran Tierney coming back into the side was huge, because being in the back three, he travels with the ball into the midfield. He's a winner. He's a competitor. But it gave Scotland an opportunity to have more possession in the middle of the park. Shea Adams also supporting Lyndon Dykes, who done very well. Lyndon Dykes done very well in this match, but I think that he would have felt so much better having someone closer to him, so that it wasn't just him alone that had to occupy the back four. I think Shea Adams is a great player, but it's a wonderful performance for England, Simon. I think the biggest news there was Harry Kane coming off as a captain.
And the speculation now is that the transfer rumours that swirling around his head are affecting him, and maybe he should be dropped for the next game. He's not going to be dropped for the next game. No, Gareth Southgate has said that. But this is the hype that England have to deal with all the time, isn't it? You know, one, and I was going to say poor results, and it's not even really a poor result. They didn't lose the game. And they're in a very good position to qualify, but there's such intense scrutiny on the big nations in football. Must be hard to live with as a player, Spider.
But you know what? Like, it bemuses me, you know? It was the second game. So England knows a point and they qualified. Mate, it's a tournament. It's tournament football. A point, you're qualified, move on to the third game. England has an unbelievable squad. So Harry Kane comes off, Rashford comes on. Mate, yeah. What's his name? The winger comes off, Grealish comes on. Mate, that's their job. That's what squad players do. Someone can start this week, the other one can be on the bench. There's a lot of matches in short time. And by the way, these players have played a shitload of matches all year.
Yeah, Spider, am I, Simon, a little bit crazy in thinking, like, Scotland, 23 years, obviously, since their last major competition. Socceroos, when we went to the 2006 World Cup, Spider, 32 years. Last game of the group, Croatia, 2006. Scotland, last game of the group, Croatia. Oof.
Yep.
I'm like, there you go.
And my heartstrings are, to be fair, like I said, quite emotional about the Scottish team, because I spent a long time here. So, I hope they do well. It's a big match. And as you touched on with Croatia, Spider, they've been a little bit toothless. So it's a big opportunity.
But what about the crowd, Maury? What's the crowd situation? How many can the Scots get in the hand?
12,000, I think. It's been 12,000.
That'll help. But by the way, what about their supporters in London? How funny were they? They had a ball, mate.
They always
do. Less than 3,000 tickets, and there must have been about 30,000 of them down there.
That's always the case when the Scots come down to London. They absolutely take over. Let's move away from England and Scotland. Spain. What's going on with the Spanish? They failed to win either of their opening two games. Their latest match, they drew 1-1 with Poland. They haven't won either match, the first two opening games at the Euros, for the first time since 1996, which is extraordinary for a team that was, you know, world champions and European champions, so dominant for so long. And that means it's now all on that final game against Slovakia in the final group game. Is there an issue with the Spanish team? I know that Luis Enrique has come under fire for not selecting Sergio Ramos and one or two others.
They're in a rebuilding phase. Look, it's so difficult when you're so successful for so long. As soon as you don't have success, it's a failure. But they're in a rebuilding phase. It's as simple as that. They're still playing good football. They're still creating chances. They're just not going in. They're not losing. They've drawn two matches, which can happen in tournament football. And you know what? They play Slovakia last game. Won't be easy, because there's no international match that's easy. But if they win, they go through with 5 points.
We'll see what happens. The Germans, Maury, everybody was writing them off.
I was one of them.
Including us. Defeats, including us.
Including us.
And what do they do? They go and smash the reigning champions, Portugal, by 4-2.
And, after going behind and I felt Portugal could do something in this match, and they got off to the right start. But I tell you what, it was an absolute brilliant performance from the Germans. It was one that I didn't see coming, if I'm being honest. They destroyed Portugal in the wider areas. The wing backs, so much space, and were so influential in this game. It's probably the best. It's been the best game, I think, of the tournament so far as well.
It was a
great game. You know, Portugal, like I said, started well, but a little bit more, you know, counter-attacking. But the Germans were brilliant, I thought.
Never ever write off the Germans at a major tournament, particularly with Yogi Löw, of course, calling it a day after this tournament, after 15 years in charge of the national team. If that was the best game of the Euros so far, I don't think anybody would have too many doubts about the best atmosphere of the final so far. That was in Budapest. 60,000 watching Hungary draw 1-1 with France, and the noise when Attilo Fiola opened the scoring for Hungary was phenomenal. But again, France showing their resilience, spider Antoine Griezmann getting them a point, which should be enough to see them through to the next phase in that group of death.
You know what? It's unbelievable. I was pumped when I seen a full stadium for a football match. There was Denmark played in a full stadium, and now this game. And the rumours are, Simon, is that they're going to move the final to Budapest.
Good. That'll be terrific.
Look, it was a 3 o'clock kickoff. It was stinking hot. Hungary played out of their skins. And France had to be resilient and showed the quality they got. And again, they got the point. They've qualified. They got 4 points. They're through to the next phase, tournament football. French doing what French do. Getting by and getting to the next round.
Only three nations have 100% winning records so far at the Euros. They being Belgium, the Netherlands, and Italy, who defeated Wales by 1-0. In fact, Wales go through as well in second place by a very narrow squeak on goal difference after Switzerland could only beat Turkey 3-1. But again, I'm going to ask you, Maury, about the Italians. Not many people fancy them at the start of this tournament, but they're now 30 games unbeaten. That's extraordinary at international level.
It's incredible. And Spider will know more about this team, but I mean, they made 8 changes today, Simon. Eight changes. I mean, eventually Wales get a man sent off, but look, it didn't matter. Like, Italy have just been a joy to watch, and the type of football, Spider, that Italy play now is incredible. You know, the days of 1-0 and the handbrake on and bunker system, mate, it doesn't happen. It's like they're still pressing, they're still working hard from the very top. Subs that are coming on are playing exactly the same way. They're looking for the second, they're looking for the third goal, they're going for the throat of their opponents. And that run of games, they're alive. I'm saying lively outsider. What I've seen so far, they're actually not an outsider. They've got a great chance to go all the way in this tournament, Simon.
Big chops. You know what's incredible? Like, you know, we spoke about it the other week, and I said Italy. I fancied Italy to win the tournament, and I fancied France to win the tournament. What annoys me, because I played in Italy, and us in Australia, we actually don't respect other leagues. Like, these guys are bloody very good players. They play at top teams. They come from a footballing culture where scrutiny is everything. Mate, detail is everything. And you think the Italians are going to go into a tournament after missing out on the World Cup, not being prepared? Mate, you guys are kidding yourselves. Yeah. These guys are all at such an unbelievable age, and Mancini has brought this team together. They work, they run, they fight, they scratch, and they can play football.
Yeah.
They are certainly worth watching at these Euros, the Italians. Last one, boys, just away from the Euros for the moment. We've mentioned his name already in this podcast. Sergio Ramos, Maury, leaving Real Madrid after 16 years, 4 Champions League winners' medals, all over a row over the length of a contract. He wanted 2 years. Real offered 1. He stalled before finally accepting that deal. And Real said, too late. It's off the table. Interesting way to treat a guy that's been there for so long. In fact, a player that's in many ways been synonymous with their success over the last decade and a half.
Yeah, no, look, it's a very, very strange scenario. I mean, what we're missing, I do not know. But Sergio Ramos's like response to say, I didn't realise that the offer had a time frame.
It's expired.
It's expired. I mean, you know, 16 seasons. You know, how successful he's been at that football club, the role that he's played at that football club to continue to, you know, I guess push that club in the best light, always playing at the top level, the highest level competition. It's sad. But like I says, you know, players, coaches, you know, we all move on at some stage, but Sergio Ramos's impact as a player at that football club has been phenomenal. And I'm sure somebody else will, you know, get the services, whether it be for another year or two. If he, you know, he was looking at a 2-year contract at Real Madrid. And when you see the pictures of him, he doesn't look too bad. Yeah. He's still in great order. Slides, he's still in great order, eh?
Mate, big chops. What a player he is. Mate, wherever he goes, he's going to be a massive asset. He's still a great player.
Where will he go,
Spy?
Where will he go? Will he go to the Premier League? Will he go to Serie A?
Who can afford him?
Well, the big clubs.
Man City. Man City can afford him.
You look at Thiago. Thiago goes to Chelsea from PSG to Chelsea at 30. Thiago's 36 years old.
Yeah, 36.
Yeah, he was on a free transfer as well, wasn't he? So
he was, and then he's extended another year at Chelsea. So, look, the Premiership can definitely afford him, Simon.
Hmm. Interesting times. Thanks, guys, for the moment. We're going to head into our final segment today, and we've got another great guest waiting for us in Footballers' Lives.
Footballers' Lives.
Well, our guest today was born in Sydney in 1976. He began his career with Marconi Stallions in the NSL and was a part of the squad that won the title in his first season in 1992-93. In 95, he joined Turkish giants Galatasaray and would stay seven seasons, even though he only featured periodically for Gala. In the intervening period, he would spend a lot of time out on loan at Antalyaspor, Bursaspor, Karabukspor and Nîmes in France. In 2002, he finally left Gala to join Gaziantepspor. Then after a spell with Mersin İdmanyurdu, he came back home to join Sydney FC. Further spells at Avispa Fukuoka in Japan, and finally the North Queensland Fury rounded out his playing career. He's since gone on to become a coach, assisting Steve Corica at Sydney. And of course, he's now the top man at Wellington Phoenix. He is Ufuk Tale. Welcome, Ufi. How are you?
Good, mate. How are you?
Great to have you on the show. Let's just run a little bit through your life. You grew up, of course, in a Turkish family heritage. Was football always your passion? Who did you support and who were your idols as a kid?
I always loved football. I think my father really loved the game as well, even though he only played at an amateur level. I started playing when I was six and just continued on through there. And, you know, there was a lot of input from my family, especially my father as well. And a lot of time and effort that he put into me to get me to my point of my career where I become professional at the end of the day. So for me, when I look back, and I'll always say this, even if I carried my old man on my back for 100 years, I probably still wouldn't be able to pay him back.
Did you have a team that you supported?
Yeah, when I was a kid, I don't know if I really want to say this, but my old man, he loved Beşiktaş. So as a kid, you know, you're sometimes pushed into supporting a team that your parents or your family supports. But look, obviously going to Galatasaray and playing for a big club like that, and then, you know, it shifts pretty quickly.
Those early days with Marconi Stallions, how much do you remember about that title-winning season in 1993? I think you were an unused sub in the grand final against Adelaide City. Is that correct?
No, I came on.
No? You came on. There you go.
Yeah, hey, come on, Simon. I still hold the record of youngest player.
Sorry, your feet.
Yeah, I think I was 17 and 52 days or something like that. So, no, I came on in that game. And for me, it was a great experience under Frank Arok. You know, and very fortunate that he loved young players and gave us opportunities back then. And hopefully we didn't let him down in the sense of doing a job out on the park as well. So for me, it was a great experience playing with some really, really good players. You know, JP, Dutchie, Harps, all those guys were there. Bimby, you know, so we had a very, very good side. And I broke into that squad very late into the season and was fortunate enough to win a title.
Would you say Frank Arrock was your biggest influence, and is there an element of him in your coaching today?
Yeah, look, I think you take a lot from the coach that you work with as a player. You know, you look at the things that they've done, and he was a big influence in my career. He was the first coach that gave me the opportunity at that level. So, you know, I've had some very good experiences with Frank. He was a very great character, a very passionate man about the game, and he was very passionate about me because I've had some good run-ins with him as I was coming through at the same time. Because I was 16 when I made my debut. And then school went a little bit haywire for me because I was focusing more on the football. And I think he got a call from school one day saying that I wasn't turning up to classes. And he called me into the office and we sat down and had a chat. And I remember this because he said to me, he goes, "I made you." He goes, "I can break you." So he goes, "Make sure." So he's had a great influence. Like I said, he's the one that gave my first opportunity that opened up the door for me to have a professional career.
And that professional career continued in Europe with this huge move to Galatasaray. How did that switch to Istanbul come about? Because Graham Souness was the coach at the time?
Yeah, Graham Souness was the coach at the time. I went overseas to doing a pre-season camp in Germany. So I joined them there. They had an idea of me the season before, but wasn't able to go that year before. So went over there, joined the group, played a few games for them in pre-season, and then flew back to Turkey, and they wanted to sign me.
And you were playing alongside some incredible players, including Gheorghe Hagi. Yes. How good was he?
He's top player, top person. You know, for me, what he's achieved in the game is unbelievable. And you learn off those players. Like, he was probably coming toward the back end of his career, whereas I was at the start of my career. So you learn a lot of these players that have achieved so much in the game.
Souness also, of course, brought in a lot of British players during his time there. Dean Saunders, Barry Venison, Mike Marsh, Dalian Atkinson, Brad Friedel, the American, was there as well. He played for a long time in the Premier League. How did they all fit into the culture, and how did the team all gel with those different sort of backgrounds?
Yeah, I think football is football wherever you go at the end of the day. Players adjust very quickly to the environment that they're in. Mike didn't last long. I think he was there for a short time and then went back. So Dean Saunders is a great character as well. Can score a goal, by the way. Quality player. And I think Barry played, was a little bit in and out that season as he was a little bit older at that time. And Brad did a fantastic job coming from there. The only problem with, I think, Brad was they had too many international games where he had to go back and forth for. So that's when he ended up, I think, making the move over to England. So, you know, that's for me, it's like a dream. You get to go overseas, play for a big club, and you get all these quality professionals around you that help you grow and make your game better.
And also some incredible Turkish players as well. Hakan Şükür, arguably one of the greatest Turkish strikers that ever lived. Did you get to play in the big Istanbul derbies against the likes of Fenerbahçe and your childhood club, Beşiktaş?
Yeah, look, for me, the first year was great. We won the Turkish Cup. I don't know if you know the history when Graham Souness put the Galatasaray yes. flag down in the middle of Fenerbahçe Stadium when all the fans started to go berserk and we weren't even able to pick up the trophy because all the coins and stuff that were flying down, the bottles that were flying down after the game, the ceremony. So, yeah, we got to play some really big derbies. We used to take the old bus down to Fenerbahçe Stadium because it used to get pelted with rocks, so they didn't want the new bus to get damaged, so we'd always take the old bus down there.
What was that like, that day when Souness planted the flag, which was a hugely provocative act? Were the players scared of what might happen? I mean, just paint the picture for us. I presume you're sort of locked in the dressing room and protected by security.
Yeah, look, it's you're surrounded by police with a lot of shields, trying to protect you to come up and get your medal for the award ceremony. It's a little bit chaotic. So you tend to try to stay in the middle of the field where it's the furthest point away from all the fans. But yeah, look, that was a great experience for me. That was the first time that, well, that was my first season there, and to see all that type of stuff and the rivalry and the passion for the game is unbelievable.
Graham Souness then left and Fati Terim took over. Is it fair to say he didn't rate you? Because that was sort of the beginning of your struggles at Gala.
It wasn't more rates. I obviously, he came in and then we went away for pre-season. Then me being only 20 or 21 at the time, I feel that I needed game time. Just being part of the squad was not enough for me, because if I was at the back end of my career and playing for a big club, you might go, you know what, I'm happy to stay here. But I was at the stage where I think game time was more important to me. So I actually asked for me to be able to go on loan to get game time, and which they allowed, which was great for me, because the more game time I got, the better it was for me, and the better exposure I get, and the more obviously experience you get from playing games. So the first year I went on loan, I think the second year I went on loan, and I had a really, really top season at Karabükspor that year. And then I actually had some really decent offers to actually leave the club, but they wouldn't let me go. So, you know, I had the chat with Fatih Terim. He told us we're playing in the Champions League. We're playing in the normal Turkish competition, and we had the cup as well. So it's one of those ones where timing is very important in football. After having a great season, I could have gone to maybe even bigger and better things, but I had another year left on my contract, so I was stuck there.
You look at your CV now, and there's all these periods of loans at four or five different clubs. Was that a frustrating period? Were you still sort of hell-bent on getting your first team spot at Galatasaray, or were you enjoying the experience of moving around to different clubs?
I think, you know, it was a bit of both. I think enjoying the experience of the challenge of going to another club on loan. I think players always, at the end of the day, want to go somewhere where they're going to play. And I think that was important to me being young at that time to go on loan. I always look back and go, you know, going to Galatasaray at a young age, was it a big step up too quickly? Was it better for me to go to a mid-table team and then work my way there? But obviously, things happen for a reason, so I ended up there at the end of the day. But for me, like I said, the most important was game time. Needed game time. You need game time. You need the experience. You know, training is great. Playing for a big club is great. But if you're not playing, for me, the most important thing was getting game time.
One of those seasons on loan was to France. You went and played for Nîmes. I think you got to the semi-finals of the French Cup as well under Dominique Bataille, who I remember being old enough to remember the 70s, playing for Saint-Étienne in the great European Cup ties against Liverpool. But you actually got relegated as well from League Two. How was that experience? There's not many Aussies going play in France.
Yeah, it was, to be honest, that's when I ended up getting out of my contract at Galatasaray and going to France. So, yeah, it was a great experience playing in France. He was a great coach. Didn't speak a word of English, by the way, which was great. But the goalkeeper coach, he was the one that did the translating for me. So I didn't get really too many remarks after the game besides Ulfie, very good. And that was it from the coach. No, for me, I had a great time in France. And that, for me, that was a move to go and get game time. And at the same time, I was becoming a free agent at the end of that season.
And that free agency led to you coming back home to Australia in 2005. You signed for Sydney FC. Was part of the reason because you wanted to get that Australian cap, which, of course, as we now know, never actually eventuated?
Yeah, look... The funny thing is, I had a lot of discussions with Frank back in the day when I was overseas in Turkey. So it never eventuated for whatever reasons at the end of the day. For me, I think the biggest thing was the family coming back to Australia. I've been away for close to 10 years in Europe. And I think it was a decision to bring the family back, as my missus's family's back in Australia as well. So it was just to get closer to family.
Is that something that grates with you, Offie, that you didn't play for Australia? I think many people say you're one of the finest players never to have won a full cap.
Yeah, look, at the end of the day, it's disappointing that I didn't play at the highest level for my country. But at the end of the day, I still got to represent my country at youth level. So we'll just take that.
It's not bad. You also won the A-League, of course, in that first season. playing alongside your old mate from the Marconi days, Steve Corriker, and a certain Dwight York. That must have been one of the highlights of your career.
Yeah, it was a great season. It was one that was, you know, we had some very experienced players that they brought back, and some familiar faces that I played with previously. And, you know, to win the competition in the inaugural season was a massive thing. Unfortunately for me, I was injured towards the back end of that season, so I missed most of those semi-finals and finals. But having players like Dwight come back and the quality that he brought to the field and even off the field with Dwight was very important for the A-League.
Give us a Dwight York story. Come on, Offie.
Not too many stories with Dwight, to be honest. he was a single man. I'm a married man, so we live two different lives, mate.
That's very diplomatic. Unfortunately for Sydney, that team started to break up a little bit, didn't it, in year two? There were issues with the salary cap, and Pierre Littbarski didn't renew his deal for whatever reason. He went off to Japan to coach Vispa Fukuoka, and a few of you Sydney boys, including Mark Rudin, ended up following him.
Yeah, it was a great experience. Japan, look, to be honest, I was, 32, 33 when I went to Japan. It was one of those ones where I could have stayed in the comfort of staying in Australia and continue with Sydney. But I also thought, you know, it's not easy to get a gig in Japan. And at the same time, this opportunity may never come again. So, you know, speaking with the family, we thought, you know what, let's go for the adventure and try our luck and go to Japan and see how it goes. And I think I had, at the age of 33, I played, I think it was 38 games out of the 42 in the J2 and ended up scoring 5 goals. I never scored 5 goals in my whole career in one season. So, you know, very enjoyable season, a challenging season at the same time, but we were lucky in the sense like I was there, Mark was there, we had Joel Griffiths over for a certain amount of time as well, so you know, we bounced off each other, but for me it was a very enjoyable season.
So the family enjoyed Japan. How did they find Townsville with the Fury?
Hot, very hot. No, the Townsville. I think the when you go to as a footballer, the smaller cities that you go to, I think there's more closeness with players and wives. I think the bigger cities, I think everyone's a little bit more distant to each other. So we had a very close knit group in Townsville, although the results weren't as close as we wanted to be. But you know, we had a very good group of players, and I think all the wives get along, and I think that's very important football when that happens.
That's sort of dealt with your playing career. Was it always your ambition throughout your playing days to become a coach? Were you looking towards that throughout your career?
Yeah, look, this is the only thing I know, and this is the only thing I think I do half decent, Simon. So, you know, I love football. The game has given a lot to me at the end of the day. And I think by coaching at the same time, I've tried to give back to not just the senior players, obviously they're professionals, but there's also younger players that we've tried to push through, even at Wellington Phoenix, where, you know, we've looked at players where I haven't tried to recycle and bring in the same players that have been at 5 different A-League clubs. You know, we've tried to think outside the box and give these youngsters an opportunity and help them to develop, and then they can go off to bigger and better things wherever that may be. That's why I probably could have played another 2 more seasons, to be honest, if I wanted to continue in the A-League and found another club. But for me, I wanted to go into the coaching side of things, and that's probably why I pulled the pin at the age of 35.
You started your coaching career, of course, with Sydney as Steve Corriker's number 2 and enjoyed success. Did you feel at that point, after that initial season, that you were ready to go your own way when you got that opportunity with Wellington? Or did it come a little bit earlier than you expected, perhaps?
No, it was one of those things. Well, it's just not just with Sydney FC. So obviously coaching down at the AIS for close to 6 years, working with the junior national team, 17s, and then taking the under-20s as a head coach for the young Socceroos. So, you know, and the experience that I've had with going away with the Socceroos and a lot of learnings. And I've been very fortunate that I've been around very good coaches and very good people within the game that have, well, like I said, you take a lot of things from the people that you work with, and if it suits you, whether you use it or not, it's up to you. But we just moved back to Sydney that season when I went back to Sydney FC, and then the opportunity came for Wellington Phoenix, and we we made the decision with my wife. Obviously, she was pushing me too because I just brought the family back from Canberra to Sydney, and now we're going to go to Wellington. And I thought, you know what, we just moved back. Do we just stay in Sydney? Because I still had another year on my deal back at Sydney. But you know, she's been, you know, for me, she's my pillar for 25 years. And she's always pushed me in the right direction, and she goes, this is what you want to do, so the opportunity is there, you need to take it.
You've just had a very tough year with Wellington Phoenix because of the COVID pandemic. You didn't quite make the finals. Just how difficult was it to basically uproot an entire club from one country and plant it in another, which of course was in Wollongong?
The hardest part was we had to get on a flight and come over very quickly, and we were probably a month behind where everyone else started in pre-season. So we come in a little bit blind when we come into the facilities and what we're going to be able to use. So for me, one of the biggest things is your training field. That's a very important part of your daily routine. And I don't think we had something that was, well, what we didn't have back in Wellington, which didn't help. We didn't have the normal routine of the boys having their own change room and all that stuff. But I don't like making excuses at the end of the day. But the biggest thing for us, the hardest thing for us this season, was not having a reserve team. Because when players got injured, we had nowhere for them to actually get game time and come back in. So it was one of those ones where you didn't want to get injured, because if you get injured and you're a regular starter, there was no way for us to get you back to 100%. And the only way we could do that was obviously play you in the A-League games, where we're trying to win games at the same time and trying to get players fit and ready to go that to their maximum again. So that was probably the biggest challenge for us this season.
Towards the back end of the season, of course, you did manage to get back to New Zealand, play a couple of home games, and the crowds responded magnificently. The two, I think, biggest crowds of the regular A-League season in Wellington and Auckland. Did that sort of convince you to sign on for the long-term project? Because there was a little bit of speculation that you might return to Australia in a coaching role at various places.
Yeah, look... you know, there was a bit of speculation. There was obviously a lot of things thrown around. But for me, you know, I try to look at it where this club gave me my first opportunity. At the start of last season, we probably didn't get the results that we wanted to get in the first four or five rounds. But the board and Rob Morrison, our owner, has believed in me and has gave me the opportunity and stuck by me during those times as well. And you know, things change to the better at the end of the day. So for me, at the end of the day, I'd rather have stayed at Wellington, which I have done anyway, and have longevity and try to build something rather than try to jump on the next thing straight away.
Okay, that leads us on to some Twitter questions. And in fact, this first one is from a listener on Facebook, Josh Eben or Eben Watson. And it is our question of the week, $100 Outback Steakhouse voucher coming to you, Josh, for this question. And he says, your recruitment fee has been spot on so far. What is your process to get players like Davila Hamed, Toma Hamed, I should say, David Ball, etc.?
Well, for me, Simon, we work in a competition that has a salary cap. So the visa players that we bring in, for me, are important. They have to be better than our local players. So there's no point of bringing in a visa player if he's not going to be better than the one that we have locally. Might as well give a young kid a chance and see that then maybe he might develop and come through. So the thing is, I think the biggest process for us is understanding the way that we want to play and, you know, the roles and responsibilities of each individual within the position. And then we look for those attributes that in that player that can play in that role. So, you know, we do a lot of homework. We rely on people in the game, like Spider. If Spider's maybe coach someone or work with someone and to hear learn about their character, to make sure that I can't spend $1 million on a player out of my cap and we get it wrong.
Simple as that. This one from Billy: would you ever consider coaching in international football and especially the All Whites?
Yeah, look, I don't know. For me, I just take it day by day and just want to do a good job at Wellington Phoenix for these next couple of seasons and what the future holds, it holds.
Okay. SEQ, or Southeast Queensland, I imagine, Sky Blues. on Twitter. What is it about playing for Sydney FC that makes ex-players such good coaches? Uffy, Popper, Corriker, Rudin, etc.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's if you look at all those guys and the names that have been thrown there, but have played at a decent level and a very good level within their playing careers. And I think a lot of hard work and grit goes into that. And I think it goes in the same with the coaching side of things. So, you know, our determination to be successful as a player, I think we have the same determination to be successful as a coach. And you put a lot of effort and hard work and do your homework and make sure you try to get things right.
Just a couple more before Spider's weekly question. This one from John Aldino. How aggressively did Melbourne Victory pursue you to replace Grant Brebner?
I'm going to be honest with you. So was there discussions? Yeah, there were discussions at the end of the day. So, you know, that's part of the game. I was a coach that was coming off contract. So, you know, club's always going to do what's best for them. But I'm not going to lie to you. There were discussions.
Okay, interesting. And this one from Ange Postecoglou Facts. Have you been watching the Euros? And if so, who's caught your eye tactically?
Honestly?
Not Turkey.
Well, that's right. I lost again, seriously, but yeah. since I've had this little operation, mate, I've been sleeping for the last 4 days, mate, so I haven't watched anything on the Euros.
Right.
But what I'm hearing that Italy's playing some really good football, so I mean, I'm hearing that a lot of teams, I don't know if I'm right or not, but Spider, there are a lot of teams setting a little bit more defensively than normal, mate. Is that correct?
Yeah, but you know why, Ulfie? Because, mate, it's warm. It's warm, so you can't play this high brand. Like the 9 o'clock games at night, they can be more offensive because they can repeat the sprints and that. But the 3 o'clock games, mate, seriously, they've been dead matches because it's just too hot. So they set themselves up, mate. They wait for the odd chance, don't concede. And if you score from the odd chance, mate, that's it.
So no, but different, no different to the A-League then?
No, that's it, mate. Set up defensively and go on. Go on the counter-attack. But you know what, Uffy? You know what the funny thing is, right? We talk about it. You're a coach now, mate. You've been in the game a long time. The game actually changes. It evolves. So there's periods of time where we say, okay, we're going to play 4-3-3. Everyone's got to attack. And then there's times where they say, oh, now, you know, Chelsea come up, Conte come up with this three at the back, and now everyone wants to play three at the back. You got to play with the cattle that you got. That suits your team.
That's right. The formation is set by the players. Formation is just for me is just a starting point. The best thing, like for me, was even last year when I came in, I only had 7 players signed. It was like a clean slate where I had an idea. I have an idea what the game looks like to me and the way that I want to play the game. And so it makes it easier then to bring in players with those attributes to be able to play that game, which set up your formation. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The formation is great, but once the ball moves, players move, opposition move, everyone moves. You know, there's a starting point, but you can't. Everyone wants to play like Barcelona, but to play like Barcelona, you need Messi in your team. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we don't have, unfortunately. So we might do certain parts of what Barcelona do, but not everything that Barcelona does.
Yeah, correct.
Uffy, I think that's just about it. We've gone through a whole range of questions. All that remains is for us to say thank you for joining us today and to wish you all the very best of luck with the Wellington Phoenix next season. Let's hope next year is a little less complicated and you can actually play your home games in New Zealand. But Spider gets the final word with his final question. Go.
Mate, I'm looking forward to this because I know he's played at some unbelievable stadiums. But you know what? You've got to tell us the best stadium you've played at, Uffy, but the one that I'm interested in is the biggest dungeon you've played at.
The biggest dungeon?
Yeah.
Look, for me, I think the best stadium that I've played at would have been the old Galatasaray Stadium before they knocked it down, mate.
Because, stadium of hell.
Yeah, that's right. The old Ali Samian is the stadium, and that was, I reckon, could hold maybe 24,000, but I think they could squeeze in a good 32, I reckon, in there. But everyone standing up. So, you know, that was when the stadium was really rocking and you know, full capacity. So, for me, that was a very tough stadium for opposition to come to.
And the dungeon?
And the dungeon?
Which one's the dungeon? Which one are you talking about, the dungeon? I'm trying to work out.
The worst ground. The biggest Kazi hole you've been to.
Oh, the worst one. Wow. The worst one's, I don't know, to be honest. Worst one is probably where we've gone to Eastern Turkey and you're playing a team that's fighting for relegation and they probably might tip some diesel into your change room and you can't get any.
Any home ground advantage matters, Ulfie. You know that.
Yeah, well, especially when you know how it is when teams are fighting for relegation in Europe, mate. They'll do everything possible to put you off your game.
Brilliant. Yeah. Just the way it should be. Hey, Ulfie, thanks so much again for your time.
All right,
brilliant stuff. That's right. Ufuk Tele. And that is us for this week. Join us next week for our final show of the season. Until then, bye for now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.